Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello and welcome to But You Don't Look Sick, a podcast for the Melbourne Writers Festival. My name is Jamila Rizvi, and in a moment I'm going to introduce you to two very special guests. I'd like to acknowledge that we are recording today on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present. I would like to acknowledge that sovereignty over the lands on which I'm on today has never been ceded, and that the work of reconciliation is very much something that is still alive and still to be done. Friends, nearly half of Australians live with a chronic illness, but many of those conditions are invisible and they are experienced in some secrecy. Today, I am joined by Bridget Hurstwaite, who is a radio broadcaster, current host of Good Nights on Triple J, and author of How to Endo. Welcome, Bridget.
Hi, Jamila. Thanks for having me.
And Jacinta Parsons, who is also an ABC radio presenter, current host of Afternoons on ABC Melbourne, and author of Unseen, The Secret World of Chronic Illness. Welcome, Jacinta.
Thank you, Jamila. Is there a link, Bridget? Radio is the common thread here.
Yeah, it is. Look at us.
Together today, we're going to reflect on the challenging path to diagnosis. We're going to look at how the medical system tends to ignore women, and we're going to be unpacking the complex dynamic between those living with illness, their bodies, and society at large. So that's not a lot, friends. We don't have to get through much at all. We've got some little things to solve.
Nice and easy. We've got, you know, bite-sized grabs to throw at you just to take on. Yeah.
Bridget, a friend asked me recently to introduce my illness the way I would normally introduce myself. So to the extent that you're comfortable, I was hoping you might tell us about being sick now and how it impacts your daily life.
Yeah, sure. I mean, funnily enough, you know, we're talking now. I just had to take last night off work, off being on air due to my endometriosis and my legal medicinal cannabis prescription. Taking THC oil kind of, you know, takes me away to another place. And it also, it's not really it's more so being responsible, I suppose, and not, you know, feeling 100% to present and panel a national radio show. So I'm coming off a bit of a cloudy state. But I mean, that is a pretty perfect snapshot into my life with endometriosis. You know, for those that don't know, in a nutshell, it's, yeah, a chronic inflammatory condition where tissue similar to the lining of the uterus, which is what we call the endometrium, it's tissue similar to that found outside of the uterus. And it's been found in every major organ of the body. It is really a whole body disease. No cure, no known cause. I had a 12-year journey trying to get my diagnosis. And yeah, I've had two surgeries. And I don't know if I'm technically endo-free unless I do have another surgical procedure to physically, you know, examine that. But I still experience various symptoms. So it's it really is a lifelong thing, life with endometriosis.
Thank you for sharing. Jacinta, I was hoping to ask you the very same question, to tell me about what being sick looks and feels like for you at a daily level.
It's such a great question. I was thinking about this because I knew we were going to have to say, introduce our illness. And I thought it's so interesting because the identity of illness is in constant change. So even though that's why diagnosis is sometimes so tricky, it's in one moment wonderful because you have a name, but in the other way, you have no real way to articulate the experience of what that is because every single facet of it kind of changes over time. So I have Crohn's disease, and I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease maybe 30 years ago, I suppose. No, 20-odd years ago. And I've gone through a really, really dynamic kind of experience of that. I've had multiple surgeries and lots of time in hospital. And the experience of Crohn's disease is so different depending on you and all the ways that you interact in the world. But pretty much, like yours, Bridget, it's an inflammatory disease, and it can actually occur right through your digestive system. So it's certainly not just abdominal or bowel. It's right the way through, which is where my disease became really complicated when for about a decade I was suffering with the perianal disease. And so that kind of, you know, took me on an incredibly intense journey. For me right now, daily though, I've found some medication in the last couple of years that has kept it and made it possible that I can live fairly normally. But as we all know here today, you never ever count your chickens, and you wonder how it might mutate and move throughout the rest of your life.
Thank you for sharing also, Jacinta. And just so that we are all being fair and we're on the same table, let me do the same thing. While I am the driver of this conversation, not an important passenger with a paid ticket, I also come to this conversation with a background of having been very unwell. I live with a recurrent brain tumour that is very pesky and grows back too often, in my opinion, and the removal of which has left me with extensive disabilities, mostly to my pituitary gland, eyesight, and hypothalamus. But we today are going to be talking about Bridget and Jacinta's experience of illness. Both of you touched on, when you answered just then, the word diagnosis. And I think for people who aren't sick, there is a bit of a theory that for most people, you have a symptom, you go to the doctor, you get diagnosed, and then you go on the tricky path to solving or treating that diagnosis, and that that's where the hard bit begins. But for most people who become unwell, that path to diagnosis in itself can be complex. And I wanted to know if that was your experience. We might start with you, Bridget. Can you tell me about getting diagnosed and the fight to be heard by your doctors?
Yeah, I mean, the struggle with the diagnosis for me started really, I guess, from the lack of knowledge and awareness. So trying to get answers for something that you didn't even know existed, or something that you weren't taught, you know, in your health curriculum, or something that wasn't discussed in a media landscape, you didn't see public figures talking about endometriosis. I certainly didn't, you know, as a teenager growing up. So that was really the hard part of even getting started, was like not knowing what I was looking for. And it also didn't help that whilst, you know, period pain is a symptom, it's not the be all end all defining factor of having endometriosis. That conversation in itself has always been deemed as taboo. So, you know, growing up, going through high school, experiencing painful, heavy periods, but not knowing that you could talk about it with your friends, because it just wasn't something we were made to feel comfortable or normalized. And then even the step beyond that, knowing that there's multiple conditions that can come as a result of painful periods, but one is being endometriosis. So getting started was probably the hardest thing. And it wasn't until I was really working a retail job with one of my friends back home in Ballarat, who was taking a lot of time off work. And she didn't really go into too much detail because, again, it was a bit of a taboo topic. But that was when I first kind of really learnt of endometriosis. You know, I first went to a doctor when I was 15 with my period concerns and was just told to go on the pill. It was an extremely generic consultation. It was like, that's the normal thing that you do when you reach this age, you know? And I didn't ask any questions because naturally at that age and naturally at any age, you trust the advice that you're given by a medical professional. So that happened, but then the symptoms extended beyond painful periods and, you know, it was fatigue and bloating and a really intense abdominal pain. And another factor is, you know, it being an invisible illness, it's wreaking havoc internally, but on the outside, I look what you would consider to be completely normal, you know? So there was just so many roadblocks along the way in terms of the conversation, the education, then the dismissal of various GPs and, you know, them kind of deciding at their own discretion whether or not you are eligible to have that condition. You know, I had a female GP who literally just said to my face after I explained to her in person my pain, she just decided that I didn't have endo. She said, others have it worse than you. So there were just so many roadblocks and hurdles, and it took 12 years for me to, you know, have that surgery and that diagnosis through a laparoscopy. And my surgeon said if I'd left it any longer, they would have had to remove part of my bowel. And I was 27, and that was such a confronting thing to hear. And then I look back on how long it took to get to that point. And sadly, that's the norm. You know, it takes on average 7 to 12 years for someone to be diagnosed with endometriosis. I think the figure has improved in Australia. Endometriosis Australia now reports 6.5 years, which is good, but it's still not good enough. So that's, yeah, really how I guess my diagnosis came to be. But that just kind of, yeah, that's just a snapshot. And that's also probably a good story in comparison to other people who've had it. You know, I know there are people who've had it much worse than me, but it's still, yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah, you have to really fight and be your own advocate when you're dealing with that kind of pain at the same time. Jacinta, did diagnosis bring relief for you or validation, or did it just bring more fear?
It's exactly all of that, because I think that first moment of diagnosis is where you go, oh, I am sick. Because what you were describing, Bridget, is that I think a lot of women go into these environments and don't feel legitimate to be an advocate for themselves. We've been told so often in our lives, oh, get over it. You know, you're okay. We feel like we aren't entitled necessarily to claim our space. And so it's a pretty incredible moment when you feel like you can, and you can say, I'm actually sick and this is a word and I can give it to you so that you know what's going on with me. But then there's an enormous amount of limitation with that word, because, you know, my sister's had that, or my brother's, or, you know, and people will tell you their experience with your diagnosis. And we all know that our diagnosis so frequently with chronic illness is so individually harbored in our individual biologies and experienced through the intersections with our class, our race, our culture, all the things that we go through, that it has an enormous limitation to it as well. And there's a really difficult period of feeling very isolated sometimes through diagnosis, because there's so much assumption that's being made about you.
It can be incredibly lonely. I think all of illness can be lonely. Jacinta, if I can stay with you for a moment, have you ever felt like your body belonged more to the medical professionals than to you?
Very, very much so. And there was a very long period of time, I reckon almost 15 years, where I shut off a relationship with my body because it was too painful to want anything for it. So I just, there was a moment where I rolled over in bed in hospital, and there was, you know, 15 medical students looking at my bottom. And because that's humiliating, and because you go through so much of the dehumanizing aspect of your body when it's medicalized, in those moments, it's just, it's not mine, and I don't care. You know, like, it's unwell, deal with it, get over it, don't want for it to have any other life but what it is, you know. So I disassociated from my body a lot, to the point where when I was meditating later on to try and deal with pain, I didn't know how to feel it. I actually didn't know how to find parts of my body, because I'd spent such a long time disconnecting from it.
Do you think that disconnection protected you?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're unfortunately in an environment where our relationship with our bodies, the way that we're taught to think about them, the way we have internal ableism, that sometimes the grief of our body is such a thing that it's so much to bear along with pain that's physical. So there's a grief, there's a loss, there's a change. And I think sometimes, I think part of our process of recovery or going through illness and acceptance is actually that kindness and that forgiveness of the body as well.
It's such an intimate thing to share with people that you don't necessarily know. As you say, the student doctor who walks in and is looking at your bottom, who you've never met before. I remember a brain surgeon saying something to me about now having looked at your brain rather than at the scans, and thinking, wow, you've seen a part of my body I will never see.
Mm.
And not that I want to see it, but that feels really unfair. I don't know if that should be that way. Bridget, has your endometriosis and the physicality of it intersected with your mental health over the period of being well? Can you talk to us a little bit about that physical mental health binary that we set up that perhaps isn't very useful?
Yeah, I think the mental aspect of life with chronic illness is really overlooked. We don't talk about that enough, and it's something that's really impacted me. I mean, first and foremost, that you look at the trauma of taking so long to receive that diagnosis, that can really do awful things to your confidence. It's almost gaslighting in the sense, taking, you know, so long to get answers. You're like, wow, am I making this up, or am I weak? Am I not able to handle this? And I think with something like endometriosis, where there is that association with period pain, and when you do have those conversations like what Jacinta touched on, people sharing their experiences about your diagnosis or your illness, even a simple conversation about your period, you know, if you raise issues about that pain, especially with another person who menstruates, and they might be, oh, you know, we all go through it, you know, just have some Panadol, you'll be right. And I think that's honestly what I struggled with the female GP that dismissed me. I couldn't help but think that perhaps she was using maybe her own experience with periods as a frame of reference, you know, and I can understand that to a degree. But as Jacinta said, this, you know, chronic illness is so individualized. Nobody goes through the same, you know, same path with chronic illness. And yeah, that really can really, really affect your confidence and whether or not you even decide to continue advocating for yourself. You know, it took 12 years for me to get answers, and there were so many times where I could have just given up. There was actually, you know, I think perhaps it could have been quicker had I continued to push through. There was times where I would just leave it for a year or two and just be like, whatever, I'll just deal with it. And then something will come up, like intense, you know, abdominal flare or something. And then I think, you know, oh gosh, I better go back to the doctor about this. Like it's still lurking over me. It's still kind of stalking me, this pain. But you kind of are made to feel like, yeah, you just kind of have to suck it up and live life with it and push through. So I think that's one way. There's honestly so many ways in which mental health can intercept with this. And, you know, Jacinta was touching on the relationship with your body, even just having self-esteem and body confidence. And I think for me, after my first surgery and having the scars, you know, on my belly and seeing them, I remember looking into the mirror the night before my first surgery and staring at my stomach. And I was like, this is the last time you're going to look like this, just like this blank canvas. Tomorrow you're going to have scars, and you know, they fade. And I think it can be really hard for people to accept scars as well, because that's a really confronting reminder of the pain that you have and continue to endure. I've kind of, you know, changed my mindset with my scars. I'm proud of them, and I feel like I've got to that point where I'm comfortable, because it's a reflection of what I have endured. You know, they're kind of little badges of bravery, I suppose. But not everyone feels that way, and that's okay. But I think that's another thing, how mental health can kind of lend in, you know, your perception of yourself. And yeah, I wish there was more conversation. I also wish, you know, in terms of the management for chronic illness, especially within the endo community, we always talk about the importance of a disciplinary approach, having physio and looking at your diet, you know, approaching this from all corners. And I think it's so important to go speak to someone and embrace psychologists. Again, it does come down to accessibility and whether or not you have the financial means to do that. That there's privilege that comes with, you know, seeking a psychologist, which is why this stuff needs to be way more accessible. But you have to unpack that trauma of going through something like chronic illness, right, Jacinta?
Oh my gosh, touching on the word trauma. I don't want to jump in yet, Jamila, unless that's where you want to take us. But my neck is hurting, Bridget, from nodding so furiously at everything you said. There's so many angles to take this on. It's so complex, because I think you'll both totally understand this nature of chronic is so hard to understand. This is not going away.
Yes.
And because it's an everyday experience often, you don't get the party at the end to celebrate it's over. You don't get a moment to say, hey, I need to really process what I've been through. It's kind of trauma on trauma a lot of the time. I've spoken to a lot of chronic illness people who've had a lot of physical pain. And while you think you might get used to pain, like, you know, you get used to needles, you get used to that, I actually found the pain compounded, so that from a trauma perspective, the more you go through, the almost harder it is, because you actually know what it is that you have to go through. You're aware of it. It's not new. And it's like, I don't know if I can go through that. And I think for me, I've been very lucky to have remission for a number of years now to actually start to process the trauma. And I don't think we have enough intelligence in, even in our psychological support, around what it is to live with ongoing illness in that kind of way. It's not your top line stuff. It's just so complex. And the way that we react, I mean, I would do things like stop taking medication. Like, and I would try and find out, why am I doing that? But the fatigue and the experience of being in a state for such a long time is very hard to kind of reconcile. So there's just so many facets of it. But I also want to throw in here, and I never really talk about this stuff because I think it's really important that we honor the pain in a way that allows people to feel it. But I also remember hitting the very, very bottom at a period in my life, and I thought, I'm either going to really drown here or I've got to find a way through. And so the suffering was an incredible motivator to really find acceptance, I think, because it was utterly too painful to deal with anymore. So it also gave me a really fascinating mental health experience as well.
Jacinta, has having chronic illness changed the way you think about death?
Oh, my God. I feel like crying when you say that, because my friend is dying right now. He's probably got a month or so to live. And I have done so much work on death because I realized fear that I was experiencing in hospital and trauma. You know, moments I've had where I actually thought I was going to die in hospital, and having those really fundamental mortal moments where you go, oh, that's me as well, isn't it? I mean, of course we know that, but we don't really know that. The process for my mental health has been, I had to go in and really face it. And I really thought I had, and I really do think I have in a lot of ways, but watching my friend die at the moment, it's like, but there's such an enormous experience that you really, the preparation for it is really hard to have. But absolutely, it's made me face my mortality in a way that I was very young doing that, and you both are. So many people are going to this state of mortality at very early and unprepared.
Yeah, I think there's that sense of, I remember finding a lot of solace in talking to my parents' older friends, because talking to people in their 70s, even though I was 31 when I was sick, first got sick, I was like, well, you get it. You've been through some pain, or you've had a major operation, or you understand what it is to face
mortality.
Friends
have died and they know what it's like to see it.
Yeah. And my friends didn't really know what to do. Bridget, the digital space is complex and it's not without its drawbacks, but it can also be a magnificent place of community, particularly for people who've been unwell and who are unwell. Can you tell me about Endogram?
Yeah, so Endogram, I guess, has been a game changer for me. I was diagnosed with endometriosis in 2018. Very thankful that the Triple J hack team decided to cover it, because I obviously had to take a few weeks off presenting my program. I'm on after the hack. And I felt it was important to kind of address why I was taking time off, and also why I was taking time off in the past, you know, rocking up to present a radio show, one that is of a very positive nature. It's called Good Nights. So I'm a bit of a hype girl, but it was hard, you know, when the pain was getting more frequent and I was literally hunched over a mic with a heat bag and trying to talk with a smile. But, you know, as soon as I press play on a song, I'm, you know, just slumped on the desk. So after hack covered my diagnosis, I just received constant messages. There was a lot of interest, and I didn't prepare myself for that. And I guess I didn't realize how common my experience was with endometriosis. So I decided, you know, 12 months later, I needed to kind of create a space dedicated to just that. I didn't want to constantly be talking about it on my personal account. Whilst I'm comfortable doing that, I felt like it really just deserved its own space. So I was sitting in mum and dad's lounge room one afternoon and was like, oh, I've got to make an Instagram. I don't know what to call it. My mum's just like, oh, just call it Endogram. And I was like, maybe. And I looked it up and the account wasn't taken. It was like a genius name. It's just like straightforward and simple and perfect. So I snapped that up and it really just grew into a really nice community. There's a lot of endometriosis Instagram accounts now, which is fantastic. As you mentioned, Jamila, there is, you know, drawbacks with social media, especially in terms of accurate information being put out there. But you can't, you know, doubt or underestimate the power of community and that being embraced through social media means. And it's changed my life. I mean, I've made lifelong friends. I'm about to go and see one of my endo besties from Queensland, you know, in a couple of days and reunite with her. We talk every day. You know, I've made connections with people who get it and who have also taught me so much about my condition. I honestly have learned more about endometriosis through social media and being connected to, you know, specialists from around the world and reading resources because I found them on social media. I've learned more about my condition than any consultation that I've had myself. And yeah, it's been so life-changing and affirming to know that what I'm experiencing is not something I have to endure a lot, you know, by myself. It's so comforting jumping on to my Endogram and putting up a story and have so many people reply and share their experiences with me. And it led me to, you know, writing How to Endo. So it's presented some wonderful opportunities, but the biggest win of all is, yeah, those friendships that I've forged and having a community and having a network that really understands me.
That is just so awesome. I had had something like that early on, particularly. Jacinta, obviously you have written a book about being unwell and about the secret world of chronic illness, but prior to writing the book especially, how did you make your closest people, friends and family, understand what you were going through? And were you ever misunderstood or underestimated by them?
Yes, and not because, and this is part of the compassion for it, I think, all as well, because we're surrounded by people that love us and care, but it's really hard to do that very well without having lived experience or the fatigue of caring as well. And I'm certainly not suggesting that that was my experience, but, you know, you work out sort of early on, because Bridget, your work mum and me, it got illness when I was in the 1900s. So we didn't have the same kind of access that you had. And I was really frightened of a community. I thought, God, what's going to happen? I didn't want to identify either as sick. And that was a big deal. Like, and I've really walked into that space right now. And I feel really proud of that. But early on, it was really difficult to do that. So trying to share it, trying to articulate it is tiring. But the friends of mine that saw it, that were in the hospital to see, have remained beautiful friends that I don't need language with, because language is just impossible. You know, sometimes it is, you know, not sensing that experience of feeling, which is incredible. So that's like gold. Gold when you don't have to use words to articulate the experience with people that you love. And of course, I had a partner that went through the entire experience with me. And when we were young, you know, and I got a colostomy bag, I laugh at that. That's not funny. But I laugh because, you know, like you did, Bridget, seeing your body transformed when you're not prepared and when it's a new transformation is quite shocking. And it's poo on your stomach. And, you know, that is not an alluring thing for a young woman, so necessarily. So it was a very challenging thing in those sorts of relationships.
Jacinta, have you had to let people go from your life who couldn't handle you being unwell or who couldn't step up to support you?
There's a few. I mean, you know, life is very long and that sort of stuff transitions for lots of reasons. There was a point where I was really cross, where I was like, I can't believe that there are some people in my life that don't get it or diminish it in a way that hurts me profoundly. And in fact, when even my family read the book, they're like, oh my God, like we know, but we didn't know. Because you can't tell that intimate story the way I was able to in the book in any other way. There was a point where I made a decision, and it was probably similar to that time where I found acceptance for my body and my illness. And it was, and it's, I don't know if this is a good thing, but I sort of had a sense that I'm actually here by myself. And I think that has to be okay. And I have to love whatever I get given to me in a way that is accepting, because it couldn't take my pain away. And that was something I really grappled with. You kind of reach out desperately for people that you love to actually make it better. And you cross when they don't. And you cross when they don't say the right thing. And that just became too much. And I think that was part of my grieving process. And so there was a very deliberate decision to see everything as a bonus rather than as a lack. But, you know, I don't know if that's the right thing, you know, in terms of any advice or anything, but it's how I coped.
I think it's a very generous thing, and I really relate to that that anger in the early stages especially. Bridget, we've talked about friends and family, but how did you disclose your illness to your employer? And you touched on this very briefly earlier, but yours is a very public employment. So how did you talk about being unwell to the people who are fans of yours and who listen to your shows?
It wasn't the most comfortable and easiest thing to do, I suppose, in terms of communicating it to my, I think what was really hard was actually in the lead up to the diagnosis, because you didn't have the diagnosis or the word, as Jacinta mentioned earlier. And, you know, in the lead up to that surgery, when I was taking time off, it was really difficult for, and I understand, I think it was difficult for my employer to kind of understand it, because the main symptom was period pain, but I didn't have endometriosis to kind of fall back on as that full confirmation / validation that it's a legitimate, you know, condition. So that was difficult. But in terms of what I find interesting, what Jacinta kind of mentioned before, and how she was able to articulate everything so well in her book, and it's easier to do that than actually have those conversations with the people in your life that you see every day and whatnot. And I have, you know, the same experience of my, you know, my mum reading my book and kind of realizing the extent of endometriosis. But I feel, you know, I've got to the point where it's actually a weird balance. I feel really comfortable talking about it on Instagram and to strangers, but when it comes to, you know, even communicating it with colleagues and still having to take time off, you know, having just taken, you know, my show last night off, I still really grapple with guilt and that it's not legitimate and that I'm not worthy to take that time off, even though it's widely documented my condition and how it affects me. And also, you know, it's almost like every month I have to take a day off to deal with it. But I don't know when it will get easier for me to feel fully comfortable with doing that. And I think it's just like, you know, feeding into, we just feel like we're constantly obliged, or it's just like our mind of how we attach ourselves to work, and we're constantly feeling like we have to keep doing that. Jacinta, you can probably relate.
I just was so excited to jump in here as well, as that, if that's okay, Jamila, because, well, not excited, I feel really passionate about the fact that we bear a lot of that responsibility around that, you know, sense of guilt and sorry, and really our workplaces are not good enough. That's the bottom line. And I feel so enraged about it after the pandemic, when suddenly we saw this enormous amount of agility with workplaces to make work accessible. Really? That was always available. And I just really think it's really important to say, and people say, should I tell my employer? I don't know that I can honestly look anyone in the eye and say yes, because we don't have environments in our workplace that actually cater for diversity properly. There's lip service, there's ideas around it, but really, you're not necessarily safe if your utility is compromised in the way that we've traditionally seen it. And if we don't change the way we think of work and change the way we encounter our humanity, we're losing so much, you know, in so many ways. And I'm so cross about this that even Bridget, you know, you embody the concern about not being able to say something, but really that workplace should be absolutely adamant about your right for health and how you need to manage that. And of course they are, we're not saying that, but I'm just saying, well, generally speaking, that needs to be the way that we are really pushing back, I think.
That's so well said, Jacinta. And I personally have felt quite a lot of guilt that during the pandemic, I have been more productive than I've been in years because I've been at home.
You can do it in bed, maybe.
I can be in bed. I can spend 4 hours typing in bed. And
have a 20-minute nap and get back in. It's not a joke. If we could honestly do that, there are so many jobs that can enable that. But there's so much control around that. You know, sorry, Jamila, it's just absolutely we still have not changed our cultural perspectives on illness. We pretend we have. We really haven't when we see how it's played out in our commercial and capitalist kind of environments.
Jacinta, let's stay with the pandemic for a moment. When COVID first hit the world, there was a lot of talk of this mystery virus only being a threat to old people and sick people as a way of sort of saying, don't stress too much. It's the old people and the sick people. And I certainly started to feel quite dispensable during that period. I wanted to ask how the pandemic has made you feel from the sense of how we've talked about it as a society. And I think throwing forward to now when we're talking about opening our world up again and we're talking about vaccination, at the same time, people like us are still vulnerable. How does that sit with you?
Again, you're tapping on my rage because I feel, you know, our voices need to raise. All we're doing is exposing the truth of how community actually sees disability and age. That's the truth. It is dispensable. We haven't made the world accessible. We haven't made the world the way it should be. Disability Awareness Days are front and center about society and how it is not doing what it should be doing in terms of ensuring access. And so what we saw in the pandemic is the truth. We saw that actually it's not us, it's other people. And those other people are the most vulnerable in our community. It's class, it's health, it's disability, it's gender. It's all the things that we already know are the fracture points. And so we're going to all go back into the normal world again. That's why I have such rage when we talk about work, because we got exposed to actually this is the truth. And knowing that you are vulnerable, it brought my grief up again, because you desperately want to explain that to the people who are close to you around you that you feel scared, but they're also going through something. And it's that same comparative thing that happens where, yeah, deal with it, you know. But unless we start seriously looking at vulnerability in our communities the way that disability exposes those vulnerabilities, we're just going to keep perpetuating the same things that we've been doing for a very long time.
Yeah, if I could jump in too, I mean, you mentioned about feeling disposable. I think also that feeling of being a novelty as well in terms of socialization with the pandemic. You know, everyone was so keen to jump on the Zoom parties and have these kind of interactions and make a real fun, you know, night of it. And then as soon as lockdowns might be lifted, back to normal. But, you know, that those are things that a lot of people who are chronically ill wanted all along, you know, and that's socialization is such a struggle when we don't feel good enough to go out and have a few drinks because a flare could, you know, suddenly rise and you don't have access to, you know, come home straight to a heat bag or whatever. You just don't know when that stuff's going to happen. And when you are on the couch every Saturday night, you feel so left out. But that's, you know, this pandemic life is the norm for a lot of people with a chronic illness. And for that to kind of sweep in, it was like a real novelty. You know, everyone got a real kick out of it for a few months and then just dropped it as soon as they could or started complaining about it. I think it was really insensitive to people with chronic illness who actually wanted to do that all along. And it shouldn't take a pandemic for these things to be realized in terms of, you know, in terms of work being accessible and socializing being accessible.
Well said. I want to wrap us up with the same question to both of you, and I'll stay with you, Bridget, first. How would you describe your relationship with your body now? Not just the physical relationship, but the emotional relationship, the aesthetic relationship, the psychological relationship?
Honestly, complicated. I think what I struggle with, and this is being completely candid about it, I suppose, is, you know, when you're a voice for your illness and people, I guess, look up to you now and expect you to talk on issues concerning endometriosis, which I'm happy to do. I think I signed myself up for that, and there's that responsibility. I think people probably often might perceive me as being completely confident within myself and my condition. This year in particular has been really testing and eye-opening in terms of how I navigate my life moving forward with chronic illness. It kind of started with, you know, I guess the end of a relationship, which, you know, this relationship was my diagnosis, and my two surgeries happened with this relationship. So now, and also turning 30, you know, being at this real interesting point in my life where you feel those social pressures in terms of where you should be if you're having a kid or being married or engaged or a mortgage or whatever. This has been a really transformative year for me without my chronic illness, but throwing that into the works and addressing everything and how I move forward. You know, I fear the day that I might have to have another surgery and the thought of doing that alone and not having a partner here to look after me. Of course, I'll have friends and family, but I think it's still something that I'm kind of, it's the relationship with myself that I'm still kind of working on and struggling with, but working on it. So I guess to sum it up in one word, my relationship with my illness now is, yeah, it's complicated. It's scary. I think what Jacinta touched on earlier, and it's an important reminder, is a chronic illness is chronic. It's constant. It's literally like running a marathon with no finish line. And sometimes it's really hard to accept that. And I have monthly grieving, honestly, when my period comes around, that's the cruelest reminder that it's constant. And I really struggle around that time. But I think at least I'm aware of it, I suppose. So I'm hopeful with a lot of things, but I'm also feeling conflicted about a lot of things. So yeah, one word would be complicated to describe, and not to be like grim about it. It's just the reality.
Thank you, Bridget. And Jacinta, what's your relationship like with your body now?
So true, Bridget. I totally agree. And my intersection as well is with age. So I have an aging body and a sick body. So it is just, I think I'm very aware it's dynamic, and I'm very aware that there's a heap of grief still in there. And, you know, it's just, I think it's a forever process of understanding ourselves as a body, you know, and I think that will always continue in my life. And it's been a great teacher, but it's bloody challenging.
I want to thank you both for your honesty and your candor and your empathy in this conversation today. For those of you who are listening, who are fellow sick people, you need to get your hands on a copy of How to Endo and of Unseen, The Secret World of Chronic Illness right now, whether or not you have Crohn's or endometriosis. Both books put words around diagnosis and pain and uncertainty and the modulation that is involved in living in a sick body. And you will find incredible warmth and acknowledgement in these two women's beautiful books. And if you are someone who is listening who is lucky enough not to live in a sick body, then the chances are you know someone who does, and the chances are that person at some point has been frustrated that you don't get it. You can do some work to help you get it just that little bit more by grabbing a copy of How to Endo or Unseen, The Secret World of Chronic Illness, or even better, both. Bridget and Jacinta, thank you so much for being with me, and thank you to the Melbourne Writers Festival.
Thank you, Jamila, for your incredible compassion and obvious understanding through your own experience.
Yeah, it was a great chat. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.